expression of appreciation. The thoughtfulness of many individual families, like the Levinsons and Fines, has led to planned gifts which help WLRN sustain and grow. Through your will or estate plan, you can name Friends of WLRN as the beneficiary of your estate or a portion of it, providing an enduring legacy of public media for years to come. To learn more about making an impact through planned gifts, call 305-350-7977.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, Monday edition. Hope you had a good weekend, Bonnie.
I did, and you?
Well, certainly had plenty of temperature out there.
And rain.
Yes, we did. Well, this hour we visit with longtime San Francisco investigative reporter Seth Rosenfeld. We'll revisit the turbulent Bay Area of the 1960s, particularly the events which surrounded the University of California at Berkeley. Seth Rosenfeld has written the book Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power, and he joins us from San Francisco's public station, KQED. Welcome to you, Seth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Afternoon
or
here,
afternoon
but that's
here.
Okay.
Okay, why don't we begin with a look at the free speech movement? Can you give us a thumbnail of that was going on at University of California, Berkeley in 1964?
The free speech movement at UC Berkeley was the first major student protest of the 1960s. It was led by a number of students at Berkeley, perhaps most prominently Mario Savio, a philosophy student. It was largely inspired by the civil rights movement. Many of the students had been involved in Mississippi Freedom Summer. They had gone to Mississippi the summer of 64 to help register blacks to vote. They had faced down the Ku Klux Klan, they had risked their lives, and they returned to UC Berkeley the fall of 64, only to find that there was a campus rule that prohibited any political activity on campus, including handing out leaflets for the civil rights movement, or for that matter, for Barry Goldwater's campaign for president. And this led to a conflict in which the students set up a card table in the middle of the main quad in front of the administration building in defiance of this rule and handed out leaflets. The campus police drove their squad car onto the quad and attempted to arrest a student. And as soon as they had loaded him into the car, students began to sit down around the police car and they held it captive for the next 33 hours. And that's how the free speech movement began at UC Berkeley.
Now, it wasn't violent or subversive, was it? Or was it considered subversive at the time?
Well, it was a nonviolent protest that used civil disobedience tactics taken from the civil rights movement. There were hundreds of students involved. Among them were a few communists, a few socialists. J. Edgar Hoover, however, saw it as a communist plot to disrupt the nation's campuses. And he ordered his agents to investigate. So they investigated and reported back to Hoover. This was really just a local protest against the campus rule. And while there were a few socialists and communists involved, they really had no effect on the protest. Well, Hoover wasn't satisfied with that. So he ordered his agents to investigate again. And once again, they reported back the same thing. Nonetheless, Hoover ordered his agents to investigate and to go beyond that, to actually harass and attempt to disrupt the free speech movement on the ground that it was a subversive movement.
In the 1950s, say, did the University at Berkeley, did it have a reputation of being sort of a haven for the Beat Generation and a lot of radical ideas?
It's fascinating. Hoover first became interested in the University of California, Berkeley, around World War II. UC was very involved in developing nuclear weapons that helped to end World War II. And there was substantial evidence that the Soviets were trying to steal those secrets from the labs overseen by the university. So the FBI's first interest in UC was really focusing on Soviet espionage. But what the FBI files show is that in the years following that, the FBI veered away from this important national security mission and came to focus on students, professors, and UC administrators whom J. Edgar Hoover believed were too subversive or too far to the left.
It's difficult. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Go ahead, please.
It's just difficult to understand if there was no threatening of national security with this free speech movement, no laws were being violated. Who did Hoover have to answer to in all this? How did he rationalize these investigations, if anyone?
Well, the FBI's original authority to investigate so-called subversive matters goes back to Franklin Roosevelt in the years before World War II. Roosevelt was concerned that there were fascist and communist movements within the United States that might cause problems during World War II. So he gave J. Edgar Hoover broad discretion to investigate these organizations. However, he never defined what subversive meant, and successive presidents continued to rely on that authority and also never defined what subversive meant. So Hoover had broad discretion, and he used it to the fullest and conducted many operations that were unknown to the American people and unknown to Congress, similar to apparently what is happening today with the National Security Agency.
Mm-hmm. So Hoover recruited some people from within the university. Who were they? Tell us about them to help with the investigation.
The FBI developed informants at every level of the University of California. And UC at this time was the nation's leading public university. It was one of the largest universities. It had millions of dollars in government contracts and had very high rankings. And the FBI became deeply involved in university affairs. The FBI developed informants among students, professors, administrators, and even among the Board of Regents. And the FBI used this information not just to protect against Soviet espionage or allegedly subversive activities, but to interfere with university policy and to attempt to get students expelled, professors fired, and even to force the ouster of the university's president, Clark Kerr, who was one of the most respected educators in the last half century.
I'd like to talk more about Clark Kerr. He seems like he's really one of the victims in all this, and he was literally caught in the middle between the student activists and the FBI, and ironically, he was condemned by both of them, which I find a little strange. Could you tell us more about him and, you know, what happened?
Clark Kerr is a fascinating figure. He was born in 1911 on a small farm, family farm in Pennsylvania, and educated in a one-room schoolhouse where a teacher took an interest in him and helped him become a good student. He went on to Swarthmore College, where he decided to become a Quaker, and he became involved in doing good works with the American Friends Service Committee, fighting poverty around the country. After that, he became involved in labor as a labor mediator and as a professor, and he came to Berkeley shortly after World War II. It was at Berkeley that Kerr tried to help resolve what became known as the Loyalty Oath controversy of the late 1940s, early 50s, in which the university sought to fire, in fact did fire, many professors who refused to sign the Loyalty Oath. And because Kerr established himself as a very sensitive arbitrator during that process, he was named the first chancellor of UC Berkeley in 1953. And later was made president of the entire UC system. So Clark Kerr had a strong independent streak, and he believed deeply in free speech and civil liberties. He was also a strong anti-communist. But the students during the 60s saw him as their enemy. They saw him as responsible for the rule that prohibited handing out leaflets on campus. On the other hand, conservatives saw him as the enemy too. Ronald Reagan, for one, and many others, believed he was too soft on the student protesters, that he should have taken them by the scruffs of their neck and thrown them out. So Kerr was very much the man in the middle.
If he was such an advocate for free speech on campus, why did he allow that rule that prohibited the political activity in the first place?
Well, it's partly a function of the times. Kerr defended the people who refused to sign the loyalty oath as a matter of principle. He believed they had the right, as independent spirits, not to be forced to sign an oath against their wishes. He also liberalized many campus rules. He expanded students' rights to engage in free speech on campus. But he did not repeal this particular rule. And he would later say that he should have taken more action more quickly to do so, that he was actually expecting the chancellor of UC Berkeley to help resolve that, but that he himself was remiss. So the irony of this is that while Kerr was very much a advocate of free speech, he found himself in this difficult position where the students saw him as their enemy.
Yeah, it's so ironic. We're speaking with Seth Rosenfeld. He's a freelance journalist based in San Francisco. He was a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner and the San Francisco Chronicle for over 25 years, and the winner of many awards. His latest book, Subversives, The FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. On today's Topical Currents, time to take a short break, and we'll be back.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. The Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau organizes Miami Spice in August and September. Close to 200 Miami Spice restaurants offer decadent three-course lunches and dinners, showcasing some of the best of Miami cuisine. You can experience signature dishes created by Miami's chefs and discover the tropical fusion of ingredients that make Miami dining so out of the ordinary. Details at ilovemiamispice.com.
Hi, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
We are the hosts of NPR's Here and Now, now heard Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m.
It's a news magazine designed to keep you up to date with the day's news.
And introduce you to amazing people far from the headlines.
It's Here and Now with Jeremy Hobson, that's me.
And Robin Young.
That's her.
Monday through Thursday at 2 p.m. here on South Florida's NPR news station, 91.3 WLRN.
And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM.
You can find Topical Currents on Facebook, a dedicated page with daily program descriptions, links to our guests, authors, and books. Facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and investigative reporter Seth Rosenfeld. We're talking about his book, Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. If you'd like to join in, that's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. And Twitter, @topicalcurrents. Seth Rosenfeld, 1964. The public had fears. It wasn't long after the assassination of JFK, and then there was reports about rampant drug use and loosened sexual mores, and they were kind of paranoid. Is that how the powers that be preyed on those fears?
Well, the 1960s were a time of great change, and it's hard to appreciate, looking back, just how radical much of that change was at the time, even though we take those things for granted today. During the 50s, students were largely complacent. They weren't involved in political activity of any kind. Campuses were pretty homogenous. And then in the early 60s, the civil rights movement sweeps the country, and a number of students become very involved in that, and they energize their campuses. And this leads to protests, and then those are followed by the anti-war protests. And this was shocking to many people who were just not used to students taking this kind of role in society. There were also great concerns due to the Cold War, the missile crisis, fears about the Soviet Union and Cuba. So the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, the CIA, and the NSA at that time were all operating with incredible powers, great secrecy, and virtually no oversight from Congress or the public. And what we now know, based on millions of pages of documents that have been declassified over the years, is that these intelligence agencies greatly exceeded their powers, and they went beyond surveillance to try to harass and intimidate and disrupt the lives of people involved in lawful dissent.
I'd like to bring Ronald Reagan into the picture. I think it's one of the more shocking revelations in your book. When and how and for what purposes was he first recruited by the FBI?
Well, one of the most interesting revelations to me in doing the research for Subversives was the FBI's secret relationship with Ronald Reagan. Reagan had always taken the position publicly that he never pointed a finger at anybody. That's what he wrote in his memoirs. But what these FBI documents show is that in Hollywood in the late 40s, FBI agents approached Reagan and told him that he was involved in a number of liberal organizations in Hollywood. At that time, Reagan was a Democrat and somewhat liberal, and that there were dangerous subversives or communists involved in these same groups. Reagan writes in his memoir, "I must admit the FBI agents opened my eyes to a good many things." But he doesn't say anything else about it. And what the FBI documents show is that subsequent to this meeting with FBI agents, actually in 1946, at his home in Hollywood, Reagan enlists in J. Edgar Hoover's war on subversives by becoming a very active informer, much more active than previously known, that he secretly gives the FBI the names of fellow actors and actresses, his opponents within the Screen Actors Guild, and that he provides the FBI with access to Screen Actors Guild records on scores of actors and actresses without their knowledge. And in later years, J. Edgar Hoover repaid Reagan for his help in Hollywood by giving Reagan personal and political assistance. And the FBI documents contain a number of striking examples of that.
Will you give us some of them?
Sure. Well, in 1960, Reagan and his former wife, Jane Wyman, became concerned that their daughter, Maureen Reagan, was living with a married police officer in Washington, D.C. Now, many parents would have simply picked up the phone and called their daughter and asked her what was going on. But the Reagans turned to the FBI and requested help in determining what was going on in her romantic life. The FBI records show that this request went all the way up to J. Edgar Hoover, who personally authorized it, even though he said in a memo it was beyond the FBI's jurisdiction. And in the following weeks, one agent posed as an insurance broker and interviewed Maureen's neighbors. Another one interviewed the cleaning lady at her rooming house. A third agent interviewed somebody at the Washington Metropolitan Police Department, and they confirmed that she was in fact living with an older married police officer and reported this back to Ronald Reagan on the condition that he never reveal the source of it. Then there's another example in 1965 where once again the FBI gives Reagan help with one of his wayward children, this time Michael Reagan. The FBI at this time was conducting a massive and highly publicized investigation into the organized crime family run by Joseph Bonanno, and agents in Phoenix, Arizona, made an unexpected discovery. The son of Joe Bonanno was hanging out with Michael Reagan, the son of Ronald Reagan. The agents wanted to interview Ronald Reagan to see if he'd heard anything from his son that might be helpful to their investigation, which, after all, was a high priority. But J. Edgar Hoover interceded. He blocked the agents from conducting an interview with Ronald Reagan and instead ordered an agent to warn Ronald Reagan about his son's unsavory relationship with the son of the mobster. And one of the most interesting documents released records Ronald Reagan's reaction when he receives this warning. He says he's extremely grateful, that he realizes that if this information became public, that it could damage any future political aspirations that he had. And He said he wanted to express his great thanks to J. Edgar Hoover, but he realized it would be unwise to do that in writing. So he asked the agent to convey those thanks.
Tell us the rather extraordinary length of time and effort it took to have these documents released, something like over 20 years, and also four lawsuits that you filed, I guess, under the Freedom of Information Act.
I first became interested in this project in 1981 when I was a journalism student at UC Berkeley. I knew UC had been the scene of many of the biggest protests of the 60s. I also knew that the FBI had been deeply involved in improper surveillance activities elsewhere around the country because much of that information had come out during congressional investigations during the 70s. So I was very curious to know what had the FBI been up to at Berkeley. So I did some research and I wrote some stories for my college newspaper, but I realized there was much more to the story. So I sent off an expanded Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI, seeking any and all records concerning the university and many different individuals and organizations. And I got permission from Clark Kerr, who was still alive, giving me permission to get his personal files. And also Mario Savio gave me permission to get his files. So I sent off this request, and I thought I'd get the records in about a year. I'd write up the story, and I'd go on to the next project. I had no idea that I was embarking on what would become a 30-year legal odyssey in which I would bring five lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, and that seven federal judges would ultimately order the FBI to release more than 300,000 pages. This was despite the fact that the FBI said in court papers that it had spent more than $1 million processing these requests and withholding this information on the grounds that it really concerned national security and personal privacy. But the judges disagreed. They said this information should be released in the public interest. And they also ordered the FBI to pay the attorney's fees for my pro bono lawyers, totaling more than $1 million.
So it was $1 million on each side?
Yes.
That was spent.
Unfortunately, it was a very expensive project.
And you stuck with it for 30 years. That's very commendable.
Well, I was very curious to know what the FBI had been doing at Berkeley, particularly because UC had played such a crucial role in developing the atomic bomb and had been the scene of first major student protests of the 1960s. And Ronald Reagan, of course, ran for governor in 1966 on a platform in which his hottest issue was cleaning up the mess at Berkeley. So I was very curious also to know what Reagan's relationship with the FBI was during this period.
We have just a short clip from, I guess, a campaign speech. You can tell us about it from Reagan.
Began a year ago when the so-called free speech advocates, who in truth have no appreciation for freedom, were allowed to assault and humiliate the symbol of law and order, a policeman on the campus. And that was the moment when the ringleaders should have been taken by the scruff of the neck and thrown out of the university once and for all. As a matter of fact, I have here a copy of a report of the district attorney of Alameda County. It concerns a dance that was sponsored by the Vietnam Day Committee, sanctioned by the university as a student activity, and that was held in the men's gymnasium at the University of California. The incidents are so bad, so contrary to our standards of human behavior, that I couldn't possibly recite them to you here from this platform in detail. But there is clear evidence that there were things that shouldn't be permitted on a university campus. Let me just read a few excerpts. The total crowd at the dance was in excess of 3,000, including a number of less than college-age juveniles. Three rock and roll bands were in the center of the gymnasium playing simultaneously all during the dance. And all during the dance, movies were shown on two screens at the opposite ends of the gymnasium. These movies were the only lights in the gym proper. They consisted of color sequences that gave the appearance of different colored liquids spreading across the screen, followed by shots of men and women on occasion. Shots where the men and women's nude torsos on occasion. And persons twisted and gyrated in provocative and sensual fashion.
That's pretty remarkable by today's standards. Tell us about that speech.
Yes, this is a really good example of the kind of speeches Ronald Reagan was making as he ran for governor. He was focusing on the University of California and trying to use it, and actually very effectively was using it, as a way to beat up on the incumbent Democrat, who was Edmund Brown, Jerry Brown's father. And this particular speech was given in May 1966 at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. And Reagan is talking about a dance that was held in the school gymnasium by an anti-war group called the Vietnam Day Committee. And what he's describing is what we now know is a very typical situation at a rock and roll dance, where there's a light show and there's loud music.
Exactly.
Reagan is greatly exaggerating activities that happened at the dance. He claims there was an orgy there, and there was no orgy. But he's using it very effectively as a rhetorical device to capitalize on some anger and resentment that many Californians had about the student protests that were disrupting the campus.
This kind of reminded me of Joe McCarthy in congressional hearings. I had before me a list of 47 known communists who were working in the State Department, that kind of idea. I wonder also if fellow Californians Richard Nixon and, say, Bob Haldeman took note of how this registered with California voters and sort of laid the groundwork for the silent majority and Southern campaign.
Well, Reagan is building a constituency that shares a common opposition to what the students are promoting. The students are promoting civil rights. They are promoting a counterculture. They're promoting opposition to the Vietnam War. And Reagan is capitalizing on opposition to that with this kind of speech. And Reagan's view of things fit very neatly with J. Edgar Hoover's. Hoover had become very frustrated with the incumbent Democrat, Pat Brown, because Pat Brown would not fire Clark Kerr. The FBI tried to go around Pat Brown by secretly leaking reports to members of the UC Regents, reports that claimed that there were subversives among the student protesters and that Kerr should be fired. And there's a series of documents released to me under court order which describe these meetings in which FBI agents give these secret memos to certain members of the Board of Regents. And these regents tried to use this information to get the board to vote to fire Kerr, but they could not do that. So finally, J. Edgar Hoover realized that as long as Pat Brown was governor, Clark Kerr would be president of the University of California. And when Reagan ran for governor in 1966, Hoover and other FBI officials saw that as a breath of fresh air. They were glad that Reagan was running. They wanted him to win. They thought they would finally have an ally in the governor's office, and they would be able to crack down on dissent at UC. And another memo that was released to me, fascinating memo, shows that one of the first things Ronald Reagan did after he was elected that November of 1966 was to phone the FBI and request a secret briefing about the situation at Berkeley. And the memo describing that meeting shows that Reagan wanted information not only about students, but also about Clark Kerr, the university president. A few weeks later, at the first Board of Regents meeting attended by Ronald Reagan, Clark Kerr was fired. So Hoover could finally take some satisfaction in what he saw as necessary to crack down on protests at Berkeley. Of course, that did not stop the protests. Protests grew, the anti-war protests grew, and the FBI continued to focus on the University of California in an attempt to stifle dissent there unlawfully.
We have a caller here who wants to know, Seth Rosenfeld, if you think there's still FBI activity on college campuses today.
Absolutely. Universities, particularly the larger schools with foreign students and politically active students, are a continuing subject of interest to the FBI. The FBI continues to have informers on campus and gathers information that it believes is necessary to protect national security, particularly focusing on foreign government efforts to use students to gather intelligence on campuses.
I'm a little mystified. What happened to Ronald Reagan that he went from belonging to these organizations, these liberal-leaning organizations, and from being a Democrat to a crusade fighting subversive activities and communism? And what accounts for his transformation?
Well, my research suggests that in the years prior to World War II, when Reagan was a rising star in Hollywood, he really didn't think too much about politics. His dad was a staunch FDR Democrat. Reagan embraced that, received political wisdom from his father, and really just focused on his career and his family. But during World War II, Reagan served in the Army Air Force Movie Corps, and he started to think about the international situation, and he produced movies, training movies for servicemen, and he saw a lot of footage of terrible combat, real combat. And after World War II, he starts to think about politics more, and then he has this meeting with FBI agents secretly, and they warn him that, or I should say they tell him that communists are supposedly infiltrating different groups. So Reagan starts to shift his views, and he's also very disturbed by labor protests in Hollywood and finds himself a target of labor unions. He was president of the Screen Actors Guild at the time, and he did not support certain strikes by different unions. So I think it's a combination of these things happening where Reagan starts to shift his political views, and he makes an alignment, the secret alignment, with the FBI and enlists as an informer. Of course, he goes on to be a staunch anti-communist later in his political career.
Right, of course. What's the difference between, did you say informer or informant, and what's the difference between them?
Well, I should describe Ronald Reagan as an informer. He was not, there's no evidence that he was paid for any information or that he was under control of the FBI as an informant would be.
I see.
But he was a informer for many years, and the FBI viewed him as an important source of information in Hollywood. And FBI documents describe their relationship, the Bureau's relationship with Reagan, as one being close and cordial.
Hmm. That's in the documents that you uncovered?
Yes. Hmm.
Let's take a telephone call or two. Our number, 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. First up, Rob in Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Good morning, or afternoon to everybody. I was a student at Columbia University and took part in the demonstrations at 1968 that just lit up the country. That summer, I was beat by the police and put in the hospital. I didn't do anything. But that summer, I was recuperating, and I was going to shift out of that into the Poor People's Campaign. But two FBI agents showed up at my father's work, seriously embarrassing him, telling them that my dad had to get me out of all these movements completely, or my older brother, who was serving on the USS Von Steuben as the fire control technician, would be court-martialed for associating with a known enemy of the state. Hmm. I, at that point, freaked out, left school, left everything, went underground, because I'd been followed by people and wondered what the hell was going on, and just totally scared. My dad's scared. He's going to lose his job and everything, and I didn't see my family for a good year at that point. I just was so, I'm shaken now as I even talk about it. It was so scary. Can I get my records from the FBI?
Well, I believe you can. Under the Freedom of Information Act, you may request your records. The FOIA, as it's called, is the main federal law that allows anybody access to records of the executive branch of government. And all you need to do is write a letter to the FBI saying, I hereby request any and all records concerning myself under the Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, yeah, I'd like to do that. You know, during the protest, they had informers in our group. We discovered one of them. He wanted to bring everybody to buy guns. We weren't doing anything illegal, and we were totally nonviolent. We were aghast at the whole thing. Only found out a year later that a guy was an informant for an FBI guy.
Seth, is it
going to
take...
Horrible time in my life. It wrecked my life.
Is it going to take Rob 30 years to get his record from the FBI?
Well, I certainly hope not. It should take probably 6 months to a year for the average request on a single individual. The tactic you're describing of FBI visits to family members of activists or to their job sites was very typical, and it was intended to do just what it did, which was to intimidate people and to chill their free speech rights. That's one of many tactics that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI used during that period.
It worked with me.
FBI agents sometimes posed as reporters to gather information or to ask embarrassing questions that would discredit people. Agents systematically conducted illegal burglaries of people's homes without warrant. In one case that was revealed in the documents, FBI agents crawled under the house of the famous writer Jessica Mitford to eavesdrop on a meeting she was having there in the 50s. Mm. But they found the meeting so boring, one of them started to fall asleep and snore, which scared the other agent who thought they might get caught. So they scurried off into the night and escaped detection.
We're speaking...
FBI agents...
Go ahead. Hmm.
Well, of course, Hoover also began the infamous counterintelligence program, which was aimed at disrupting and neutralizing people who were involved in dissent. And this was a completely unauthorized program. The Attorney General did not know about it. Congress did not know about it. But millions of dollars of tax funds were spent on this program, which was completely unconstitutional and unlawful.
It's amazing how much he got away with.
Well, Hoover created the FBI in his own image and presided over it for nearly 50 years until he died in 1972. And he was so effective at gathering information and using it that he intimidated many potential critics, particularly people in Congress, who, as a result, there was no effective oversight of the FBI for all those years.
Is there now?
There's much more effective oversight than there used to be. The FBI is a very different organization today. There's much more accountability. But nonetheless, intelligence agencies like the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, operate with great secrecy, which they need in order to do their job. And this combination of secrecy and power is the perfect storm for excessive use of government authority and exceeding that authority. So it's very challenging to have effective oversight, and it's really incumbent on Congress to take that on. And there's now a move afoot in Congress to revise the laws concerning the National Security Agency. Really, Congress had no effective oversight over the intelligence agencies until the mid-70s, when Senator Frank Church of Idaho held what became known as the Church Committee hearings. And these hearings, in the wake of the Watergate scandal, were the first and to this day remain the most comprehensive investigation of America's intelligence agencies, and they revealed extraordinary abuses of power across the board. And it's time once again for Congress to exercise its oversight authority and look into the operations of the intelligence agencies.
We're speaking with Seth Rosenfeld. He's an award-winning freelance journalist based in San Francisco, and he's written Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. Another short break, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by MIA Acupuncture, providing care and traditional Chinese medicine for symptoms such as chronic pain, sports injuries, women's issues, anxiety, and insomnia. Information at miaacupuncture.com. Hazardous waste like oil-based paints, pool chemicals, and pesticides don't belong in the trash can. Help protect the environment by safely disposing of household chemicals at a home chemical collection center. Information at miamidade.gov/publicworks or dial 311. When you start or renew your membership through the mail or online, you help to make WLRN's programming possible, and we can spend less time fundraising on air. If you received a membership reminder in the mail, please send your check in today, or you can give online at WLRNradio.org, and thanks.
You can earn an accredited MBA from Florida Atlantic University. FAU offers a professional MBA on weeknights and an executive MBA on weekends. Programs that start in August include individual leadership assessment and executive coaching, an international trip option, and VIP service. GMAT is waived for qualifying students. Information sessions and more available online at faumba.com. That's faumba.com.
And we return, Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and investigative reporter Seth Rosenfeld. Let's, Seth Rosenfeld, if you could talk a little bit about FBI agent Mark Felt, who, of course, later we found out had been Deep Throat in Watergate. Mm-hmm. How did he fit into this picture?
Well, Mark Felt came up through the ranks of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and became one of his most trusted assistants. He became the number three man in the FBI. He appears in the documents that I've seen as somebody, a supervisor, who visits different FBI offices and makes sure that the offices are operating according to bureau procedure. There's a number of documents that indicate he met with Governor Ronald Reagan in the 60s as part of these supervisory activities. And chatted with him and helped to cement the relationship between the FBI and Ronald Reagan.
And
of course,
I'm sorry,
years later, Felt emerges as Deep Throat. He was very concerned about abuses of power by the Nixon White House and was fearful that the information the FBI was gathering about Nixon's abuses of power would be stifled. And that's why he became Deep Throat, the source for Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein.
Did this business at UC Berkeley sort of set the stage for the Watergate mentality among high-ranking Republicans?
Well, it certainly contributed to it. The Nixon White House felt that student protesters were the enemy. And Nixon compiled an enemies list of people. He had the IRS conduct audits of people on this enemies list. He relied on information from J. Edgar Hoover about his opponents, his critics, and student activists. So it was very much part of this incredible cultural and political conflict that developed during the 1960s and into the 70s. And which in certain ways continues today as the culture wars still being played out.
Who was this Richard Aoki, and why has there been so much controversy surrounding your information that you wrote in the book about him?
Well, Richard Aoki was an activist in the university community in Berkeley during the 1960s. And he became a prominent leader of the Socialist Workers Party, and later in the Black Panther Party and in other campus protests. And during my research, I discovered that he, the whole time, had been a paid FBI informant. And I did a lot of research on this and was able to confirm the information I had and wrote about it in my book. When this information came out, it was very shocking to many of Aoki's colleagues who knew him as a radical leader. And a number of them refused to accept it. And they attacked me and they attacked my research as being insufficient. Shortly after I made that disclosure, quite by coincidence, the court in one of my Freedom of Information Act lawsuits ordered the FBI to release additional records on Richard Aoki. And these records confirmed what I had reported. In fact, they showed that he had been a paid FBI informant for 16 years. And during this time that he was a paid FBI informant, he had provided the Black Panthers with some of their first firearms and firearms training. The documents don't show whether the FBI was involved in that mm-hmm. in any way or knew that he was giving the Panthers guns. But they raise some very troubling questions about what was the true role of Richard Aoki. And I have asked the FBI for explanation about this, but to date they've refused to comment on it.
Are you still waiting for an explanation?
Well, I'm still conducting research into Richard Aoki and his relationship with the FBI and hoping to find out more about it.
Briefly, if you could tell us a little bit about Hugh Burns, the Undertaker, and how he fits into this.
Hugh Burns was the president of the California State Senate and also head of the State Un-American Activities Committee. This committee was similar to other committees around the country, which were set up in the 50s and the 60s to investigate so-called subversive activities, and which operated with wide authority to investigate people, to subpoena them, and force them to testify at hearings. The FBI documents show that the Bureau had a close working relationship with Hugh Burns, that there were exchanges of information, and surprisingly, some of the documents show that the FBI had received allegations from some of its organized crime informants in the 40s that Burns was the owner of a brothel in his home district of Fresno, and that Burns was involved in corruption involving gambling and prostitution. The records show that the FBI never took action on that. They did not develop that information or investigate Burns for possible criminal activity. The FBI did not refer that information to state authorities. And it appears that the reason J. Edgar Hoover looked the other way about these alleged criminal activities of Hugh Burns was because Burns and the FBI had common cause in fighting subversives.
Do you feel that Ronald Reagan's political success, not just as governor, but as president even, was based largely on the secret relationship he had with the FBI?
I wouldn't go that far.
Okay.
What I would say is that at a key point in Ronald Reagan's life, in the mid to late 40s, when he was going through a lot of personal changes, beginning to think about the world and politics seriously for the first time, that his secret meetings with the FBI had a profound influence on his political view. As we've said, he became an informer in Hollywood. He developed a secret alliance with the FBI. And I think that contributed to his becoming the politician that he did. But I think Reagan would have won even without the help that the FBI gave him along the way. He was a very hardworking, charismatic figure, and tapped into populist concerns that propelled him to office.
Well, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Seth Rosenfeld. He's based in San Francisco, an investigative reporter, and he's written Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals, and Reagan's Rise to Power. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps up today's edition. Apologies to the callers we couldn't get on. It was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads of this and previous programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. And more information as well at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program looks at the history of U.S. financial breakdowns. There have been many, besides the 28 crisis and, of course, the 1929 market crash. Consumer debt has been behind each one. And today's calendar, on this day 1938, 75 years ago, the birth of news anchor Peter Jennings in Toronto. At the age of 9, he hosted his own radio show on the CBC called Peter's People. And on this day 1957, 56 years ago, Jack Paar debuts as host of The Tonight Show, previously hosted by Steve Allen, followed by Ernie Kovacs. And after Jack Paar, guest host filled in for 6 months before we heard, "Here's Johnny." One more while we continue to California Dream. On this day, 1974, 39 years ago, the death of singer Mama Cass Elliott in London of heart failure. She did not choke on a ham sandwich. We leave with a thought from Jack Paar, whose career was advanced by Jack Benny. Quote, "Doing the show was like painting the George Washington Bridge. As soon as you finished one end, you started right in on the other." Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Stay tuned now for Here and Now from NPR News.
This is 91.